is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Let's make it through this together.
This is Daniela from STEM Champ. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Query.
Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
It's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Query every third Saturday at 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. And I lose control, think I follow
home. There's something missing and I'm lit and I got something to say. Oh yeah. All of the witches and the demons better get out my way.
Good evening. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. My name is Emma, and I use she and her pronouns.
And I'm Marcy Grace Frederick, and I use she, her pronouns.
Hi, I'm Sheila, and I use she and her pronouns.
Great. So today on Transpositive, we're going to be talking about two recent events in our community that have really deeply affected us all. First, we're going to be visiting with Marcy and remembering Claire Hall, who recently passed away. Claire was a Lincoln County commissioner and a transgender woman who had served 4 terms in the Lincoln County Commission. And she just passed away in early January. And then for the second half of the show, we'll be talking about Karen Good and the implications of the ICE murder of this, you know, this really wonderful heart-filled lesbian woman who was part of our community and was murdered by ICE this past week. So let's start first by, we're going to talk about Claire. And so to do that, we'd like to have Marcy on, because Marcy was a good friend of Claire's, and Marcy has a lot that she can share with us about Claire and her life and some of her own memories of Claire. So Marcy, welcome to Transpositive.
Hi, thank you.
Thanks. So let's start by just reviewing the facts, Marcy, can you tell us when did Claire pass away, and who was Claire?
Claire was our Lincoln County Commissioner and a very good friend of mine, and she passed away on January 4th.
Thanks. And her life is just something that I think we really want to celebrate. Claire was one of only a handful of people who've been elected to office in Oregon who are transgender or non-binary. And, you know, just the fact that Claire had the courage to go to work every day and to represent her community as an out trans woman is just a real cause of celebration. Do you know a little bit about Claire's backstory, Marcy? Like when did she begin her term as a Lincoln County Commissioner? How is that going for her?
I don't recall the year that she started and that she became the Lincoln County Commissioner, because that was pre-transition. I do know that she did run while in her transition and transitioning, and I met Claire prior to her transition in a couple of community advisory committee meetings. And so that's where her and I's first relationship started.
Oh, great. That's really wonderful. Thanks. Thanks so much for sharing that, Marcy. So I want to share a little bit about Claire's backstory before we get to talking about some of your memories of her and also asking you some questions. Claire Hall was a transgender woman. She was a public servant and a Lincoln County Commissioner in Oregon. Claire made history by serving in elected office while living openly as a trans woman, bringing both professional experience and lived integrity into the often unseen work of county governance. As a commissioner, Claire was known for her commitment to local decision-making, community responsibility, and public service rooted in fairness rather than spectacle. Her presence in office mattered, not because she sought to be a symbol, but because she insisted that transgender people belong everywhere that decisions are made, including at most local levels of government. Claire's life and work expanded what was imaginable for trans people in public life and reminded her community that representation is not abstract. It's practical, human, and consequential. Her death this past week is a profound loss to Lincoln County, to Oregon, and to the broader transgender community. Her legacy lives on in the doors that she helped open, the assumptions that she quietly dismantled, and the simple but radical fact that she showed up and served. Marcy, how did Claire describe her own journey as a transgender person? Did you ever have a chance to hear Claire talk about that?
Claire and I discussed different aspects of our transition and her transition as she progressed. I remember that her and I didn't get real close until after she had already started her transition. So her and me we hadn't communicated pre her transition. And I don't know how much of me that she knew of while I was in transition, because I started just a year or two before her. I'm sorry, what was the question again?
No, that was a great answer. Thank you. Thanks so much. Sheila, as I'm asking Marcy questions, would you like to ask Marcy questions as well, or say anything about Claire?
Well, one of the things that I think is somewhat significant is the trans experience. In the early days, there was a real distinction between early transitioning and midlife transitioning. I was just wondering at what stage of her life experience she did actually transition.
Oh, it was her later life that she transitioned. It was just a few years ago. I feel like it's been maybe 8 years because it's just coming up on 10 for me.
Well, the reason that that's somewhat significant is because the style of trans existence very much is influenced by the stage of life in which people do this. And sometimes there's a division between, just as we see in ordinary everyday life, is that the issues that we face in later life are radically different than this, than what we face in our 20s and 30s. And it has an impact, and it also has an impact on the motivation of the transition. Many people look at late life transitioners and they think, if this is as real to you as cross-gender identification is, what took so long? And I can partially answer that. I was an early transitioner myself, but I can say that for many people, their life experiences, often including a career objectives and or a marriage and having children, often mm-hmm. delays people making the decision until later life, because that's the first time they've either had the means to do it or they've had the opportunity to ask themselves a personal question that they didn't feel was able to be asked at an earlier stage, or they felt that they owed something to the raising of the children. There's still a prejudice against transgender parenting, and a lot of that plays into it. But it's also interesting in this particular case of someone that is adopting a public role, because mm-hmm. the supposition always, unfortunately, with our community is that we are so caught up in the fact of having transitioned that every other aspect of our life is made de minimis in comparison. And it's some assumed that we spend all of our time transitioning and we don't have other aspirations outside of just being who we are. So in other words, we're reduced to our sexuality to a degree that is not applied to other people who do not have to go through this process in life.
Right. Well, I think for Claire, I think it was kind of a combination of all of that, because within her journey, from what her and I had discussed, she had known from early time that there was something different about her, right? But we didn't have the language that we have now to necessarily describe our feelings and what we were going through. And I also know that Claire was also attracted to women. And so I think that also was a pull, you know, because it's like, well, if I'm attracted to women, then I'm not gay, right? Being perceived as a male. And so I think that was just a big struggle with her sexual identity and coming to terms with all of that. And so I think with Claire, it was a little bit of everything all in one.
Thank you. So I'd like to ask a question now, Marcy, and Sheila too, that I think we really need to discuss, because I haven't heard it discussed in the media yet. And that's the recall effort and the impact that it had on Claire's life, because Claire died 2 days before a recall election had been scheduled in Lincoln County. It was the first time in 125 years that there had been an effort to recall an elected public servant. And it just happened to be a transgender woman and someone who's already served 4 terms and was in her 5th term as an elected representative. Claire had a spotless reputation as a community advocate. She worked strongly for issues regarding fair housing, homelessness. She helped to raise awareness about the attempts to build an ICE facility in Newport, which there's still mm-hmm. conversation about. She worked to help get the Coast Guard the helicopter back, even though she was recovering from a broken hip and several broken bones, and was in respite, trying to recover, but she still worked to help get that Coast Guard helicopter back. But in spite of all of the work that Claire has done for the last 4 terms in Lincoln County, there was an effort led by some people who may have had motivations which were less than moral to recall Claire Hall. And they may have been rooted, at least in part, in transphobia and the very real expression that transphobia causes, where it will, like, for Claire, as somebody who's in the public eye, it may have been that transphobia was one of the motivating factors behind the effort to try to recall Claire. And what I'm wondering, a couple of things, Marcy. One is, I mean, what kind of impact did that have on her, especially considering that she died just 2 days before the recall effort? I mean, it's just so heartbreaking.
It tore her apart. This is really hard for me because I've seen the things that they said about her and they're still saying about her, and it's really hard to be in any public comment sections right now because I think that ultimately, in my belief, is what killed her. I think her health was not that great. A lot of people don't know that after her fall and fracture of her hip and her shoulder, she almost died in the hospital once. So her body had been through a lot already. Mm-hmm. And she was still just trying to do the best she could for our county and the people in it. And there was just so much hate thrown at her. And it was really hard to watch. And I know it tore her up.
How did you feel witnessing that, Mercy, that hatred coming from... Did you expect people in the community to be so hateful? I mean, or was that a surprise to you?
It was a little bit of a surprise because it actually splintered our trans and queer community itself. And people were on opposite divides and nobody was getting along. And it just seemed like people weren't seeing the blatant transphobia that was being perpetrated towards her on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And it was just hard. Yeah. Especially with the queer community here, and some of the tough conversations I have had to have with some of my friends. And you know, that wasn't always easy.
Yeah. Yeah. Sheila, you've been a resident in the past. You've been a resident of Lincoln County. Does it surprise you to hear that Claire was the target of so much public transphobia as part of this recall election?
Well, during my time down on the coast, and I'm not an actual resident, I'm still a resident of Washington State, but in my time down there, I've never had any difficulties. But of course, during the COVID pandemic, I spent most of my time on the beach or actively writing. And so I haven't had a whole lot of times where I would run into problems. But what I have some questions is that in order to have a recall campaign, there presumably were some instigators of that. What was the announced reason for even doing something, particularly with someone that had served already for several terms? It would seem like if there was going to be prejudice or problems, it would have manifested itself earlier than this. So what was the triggering event, if I can ask, because I'm approaching this with no preparation whatsoever.
And so, Sheila, just a little backstory too. The recent election that Claire won was a very tight election. It was very close, but Claire was definitely somebody who was very concerned about affordable housing Correct. You know, we know how incredibly expensive housing has gotten on the coast. She's very concerned about homelessness and making mm-hmm. sure that homeless people are housed, you know, because we've seen how hard it can be for people in Newport and on the coast when they are homeless. And, you know, she was concerned about immigrants, about LGBTQ people, about women, you know, about the health of her environment. One thing I'll say about Claire that I just know is that Claire was one of the most knowledgeable Lincoln County commissioners I've ever met. I mean, she knew her district so well, and she knew everything that was going on. If I ever had a question for Claire, like, she knew what the answer was. She could explain it to me, and she was always available. You know, even though I don't live in Lincoln County, but when I had a question about news from Lincoln County, I would write to Claire, and she would write back to me right away.
Yes, she always made herself available, it seemed like, for everyone, and that's just where her heart was. She just tried to help everybody. It didn't matter who you were.
Yeah.
I have a few other questions about just the mechanics involved in a recall election. In order to have the recall election, what is the actual process, and is there an initial burden of proof that has to be brought forward?
No. I can answer those questions for you, Sheila, because I'm pretty knowledgeable about Oregon politics. So in order to do a recall election, they had to gather 3,000, I think it was like 3,900 signatures or something like that. The motion that they made was specifically to recall an elected official. There doesn't have to be it doesn't have to be a specific violation. It can be that, you know, that they just don't like that person. Maybe they don't like the way they voted or something. And this was obviously an effort by the same people who worked so hard and put so much money into trying to defeat Claire in the last election to trying to get rid of her again. I mean, it's just the kind of dirty politics that Republicans and conservatives are doing right now. I mean, you know, we see what they're doing in other states, you know, the dirty politics that they do. And Claire was, you know, a target in part because Claire was transgender, even though Claire had a spotless reputation, you know, and she, so they had to have 3,900 verified signatures from people who lived in the district, which they did get. And so there was mm-hmm. a vote scheduled for January 8th. Now, Claire has like had tremendous support in Lincoln County. And so it's likely that the recall effort would have failed, especially considering.
I think so.
Yeah. But that's the mechanics of it, Sheila.
Well, then what it sounds like to me is it sounds like a sour grapes second chance to rerun the election, hoping for a different result the second time. But then after her death, then presumably the recall election was no longer valid because the person was gone. So is that how it's basically shaped up? So basically she died in office, if I'm understanding this correctly.
That's correct. Right. Yes, she died in office. Yeah. I'm not sure if a new commissioner is appointed or if there's a new election.
But her distress was undoubtedly due to the fact that that this was even happening, because she took this presumably personally. Is that what I'm hearing, Claire?
Oh, are you asking me?
Yes.
I'm sorry, what was the question again?
Well, I'm assuming that her distress was related to the fact of it even happening, regardless of whether she would have likely prevailed or not. It was simply the concept of having a recall election after so many terms of successful representation. Is that correct?
Yes, correct. And it was just it was blatant transphobia behind it. I mean, you know, as much as people want to deny it, it was.
And how did that change? How did that affect members of the LGBT community out there on the coast? Was there a division of opinion at that time? You said
yes.
Something earlier. And so yeah. I was wondering, why did the community not back her 100%?
Because there were rumors about things that a lot of times come at us as trans people, that, you know, were groomers or pedophiles, or, you know, I heard that word towards Claire. And, you know, just they demonized her. They demonized her, and it was easy for them to do that.
It's like, Sheila, think about, you know, I mean, as people who are victims of oppression, as people who are targets of oppression, when one of our own community is under attack, you'd think that a community that's already subjugated, a community that's already under so much like stress, would like come together. But in reality, the world doesn't really work that way. People who are marginalized, mm-hmm. isolated, and splintered react in this really awful way to their oppression. Like sometimes they'll like even react with in their own internalized oppression and targeted at other members of their community, because it gives them some kind of a psychological relief to take out their own anxiety and their own like their own trauma on other members of their community. And even though human beings shouldn't be like that, that's often how we are. And it's, I mean, that's why the more oppression that a group suffers from, the more likely it is to have this kind of dysfunction. But I mean, there must have also been, Marcy, people within the LGBTQ community who were really outspoken for Claire and supportive of Claire.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, she had a lot of support and great support. It just, you know, I think it tore her up how it splitted the our queer community here on the coast, how, you know, divided they were. And like you said, it like brings out the worst in us sometimes, and we turn our own internal homophobias or transphobias onto, you know, people that we should be supporting.
Marcy, what conversations did Claire start that will continue after her passing?
Oh my goodness, such a hard question. She had all kinds of conversations. I think one of the biggest conversations is the acceptance of trans people. I think she found acceptance in her transition, and I think she gave a lot of people courage, including me.
Yeah. If Claire...
That's going to carry a lot of weight. It's going to carry a lot of weight for a long time.
If Claire could speak to trans people right now, what do you think she would want them to hear?
Probably to lead with love and lead with kindness.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how I remember Claire too. I mean, she was just such a... I mean, you look at pictures of her, it's like... You were talking before, Sheila, about late in life transitioners, and I mean, one thing that I know, Sheila, about Claire was that she was a really happy person. And I mean, every time I met Claire, she seemed to be really joyful and really happy with the fact that she had chosen to transition, and she did it very publicly. I mean, she did it in the Oregonian, and everybody had a chance to get to know Claire. And you know, after that coming out in the Oregonian, you know, she always was there for the community. She came and spoke at our Transgender Day of Remembrance Vigil a couple of times. She was a speaker last year via video. And, you know, Claire was just always a very optimistic, very forward-looking person. I mean, she was carrying so much more than most of us ever will. And she did it with so much grace and with real love, you know. I mean,
thank
she really
you.
Yeah.
Yes, she had a tremendous amount of grace and courage.
Mm-hmm. Now, Claire, what was the final cause of her death? Was that determined?
I'm not sure. The last I was told, she fell, so I don't know if her fall was something from internal and she died from the fall, or if she had something more. I haven't been able to speak with her niece about it yet, so I wanted to speak with her before I, you know,
says anything. Well,
yeah.
The one thing that I can say about somebody that is put under those kinds of pressures, it's the alarming thing from my point of view is that it's even more shocking when you feel your transition is completed and you've done everything you can and you feel that you've escaped the trans issue so that you can concentrate on all the other things in life. Because the whole point of transition is that as you go through it, the idea is that finally you've done your transitioning, you are transitioned, it's over. And it's unfortunately the Trump administration has in trying to make us disappear as a community, it has forced us back in time to issues that we thought we had solved so that we could go on with our life. And sometimes that comes as a great shock because it's like being sent back to square one when you think at this point you've arrived and you've done everything that can be done. And after long term in office like that, the last thing you expect is a recall. But we know from Trump's own treatment of his own election, the idea is that enough is never enough, done is never done, and the idea is you always get a second bite at the apple, and that's why we have that man in office at this present time.
So, thank you, Sheila. So, we're going to close out this segment. Marcy, I just wanted to ask, is there going to be any kind of a public memorial or a public remembering of Claire within the queer community that you know of coming up?
Within specifically the queer community, I haven't heard of anything, but there is going to be her public memorial at the Maureen Hatfield Center here in Newport January 31st at 1 p.m. So, and that's open to the public. So.
Great. So a great chance to remember Claire. And this will air before that. So we'll make sure that segment gets in. Marcy, thank you so much for joining us on Transpositive. You're welcome to stay for the second half of our conversation. We're going to be talking about the murder of Karen Good and the implications of that for our LGBTQ plus community and for immigrants' rights. So,
okay. Yeah, I'd like to stay and listen.
Okay, great. Okay, Sheila, let's go ahead and lead into a discussion about Good. I have a segment prepared I'd like to read first, just kind of to talk about what happened. I'd like to take just a little 5-minute break, though, but for the...
one.
Okay, we're back. This is Emma, and we're here with Marcy, who joined us for the last segment, remembering the life of Claire Hall, Lincoln County Commissioner. And we're also here with Sheila. And now we're going to be shifting gears. We're going to be talking about the recent ICE murder of Renee Good, who is a member of our LGBTQ plus community. You're listening to Transpositive Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. So tonight we're going to be covering a story that's reverberated across the country, the fatal shooting of 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good by an ICE officer in Minneapolis this week. Renee Good was a mother, a poet, a writer, a beloved friend and partner. Her family described her as kind, compassionate, and full of life. And she was queer. She was visibly, openly queer. She was a member of the LGBTQ plus community and a U.S. citizen, and she was deeply loved by her wife and 3 children. And her wife was actually there when she was murdered by ICE officers, and they had literally just dropped off their 6-year-old at school when she was murdered. According to local reports and multiple videos widely shared online, federal ICE agents approached Renee Good while she was in her vehicle. She was being really friendly and waving to them and telling them that they could go ahead. And she was saying that she wasn't mad at them. And an ICE agent opened fire and shot her in the face, causing her to lose control of her car. And her car crashed into a parked car across the street. For 15 minutes after she was murdered by ICE agents, there were people around who wanted to render aid who were not allowed to render aid. Federal officials from the Department of Homeland Security and the White House have defended the shooting as an act of self-defense, even though clearly it wasn't. It was clearly a murder. Footage from eyewitnesses from human rights groups tells a different and very troubling story. Video shows officers confronting her SUV and opening fire at a close range as she was slowly moving away, raising serious questions about deadly force. Well, in my mind, there's no question. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey has sharply criticized the administration's account, disputing claims of self-defense and calling for ICE agents to leave the city. Minnesota is also investigating whether or not to prosecute the ICE agent for murder. Community members have mourned and protested. Crowds have gathered in Minneapolis and other cities in vigils and demonstrations demanding accountability and justice for Renee Good's death. This shooting has also sparked broader national reactions, from a moment of silence at a Timberwolves game to celebrity protests at the Golden Globes, where the stars wore pins opposing ICE and calling attention to the killing. Beyond the politics of controversy, there's a human story that we shouldn't lose sight of. Renee Good was a wife. She was a mother. She was a partner. She had three children, a life full of relationships and meaning, and people who will grieve deeply for her for the rest of their lives. Her mother described her as one of the kindest people she'd ever known. Renee Good was an artist and a poet whose humanity extended far beyond the moment of her death. There are still questions that need to be answered about what exactly happened, but it seems very clear that this was a murder. It was completely unnecessary. It was violent and brutal, and it was something that was intended to cause harm to the LGBTQ plus community, to the community of people who supports immigrants and migrant people living in this country, and to anyone who really has a kind heart, which is actually most Americans. It just happens to be that the people occupying the White House have cold, shriveled black hearts that are just little tiny shriveled pieces of nothing, you know, and they're just the cruelest, most cynical people. Right away they came out and they tried to defend the murder of her. They tried to label her as a domestic terrorist. They said that she was responsible for her own murder. And they went right away on the offensive against her and her character. And you can just see her beaming and smiling and waving in this really friendly way to the ICE officers as they approach her car, saying, "I'm not mad at you." You know, and her mother says that she's the most loving, generous person that she's ever known. And for that, she got shot in the face by ICE. And if that doesn't tell you something about what ICE is and what they're up to in this country with undocumented workers and with people who have lived here for decades, then you need to do some learning, because ICE is not here to uphold the law. They're here to do exactly the kind of thing that they did to Renee Good. So that's my comment. Marcy and Sheila, would you like to talk about this?
I certainly would. I'm hoping that this is going to be a George Floyd moment, and that her name will not only not be forgotten, in fact, many of the signs say her name. In other words, don't reduce her to being just a cog in the wheel of two different narratives. And the narrative that already exists in the Trump administration is that, number one, there is an enemy within. Number two, the enemy within is so broad and ill-defined that it is all under some blanket of the ideological appellation of being Antifa, which means that if you it's an expandable box. It basically could include just about anybody, including those that are simply asserting their First Amendment rights. But let's just take a worst case scenario. Let's say that that vehicle was deliberately blocking the ICE agents. There are no other streets that they could go around. In other words, was she in any way prior to that car moving a threat? Was she armed? No. Was there any evidence that she was armed? No. Was there any evidence from her words or manner sitting in her private space of an automobile that she could even be arrested? At the very most, some traffic violation. Was there any effort in what we saw to do anything other than clarify, why are you here? Why did all these other officers rush the driver's side at the very moment that she's saying goodbye to the man who shot her in a very non-offensive way and clearly solving the problem? Because if she had been allowed to complete her turn without being shot, she would no longer be blocking any traffic whatsoever. So at the very most, this is a minor traffic violation. Is this where we execute people? We don't place them under arrest. We don't give them a trial. We don't involve anybody else. We basically shoot them. And then the supposition was that the reason she was shot was because somehow she was trying to ram the officer. Is it possible that you can both film with a camera on your own hand and talking to a woman and then holding a gun at the same time? If you have to drop something, what would you think? Would you drop both? Would you back up? Would you maybe say, maybe I'm not the one to make the arrest. Maybe these other four guys can jump back in their cruiser and do a chase scene and basically pull her over? In other words, there is absolutely no way from what we've seen and what everybody in America has seen that this was anything other than an assassination. Now let's go a step further and ask ourselves, if these people are federal officers, wouldn't you think they'd have sufficient training to know how to de-escalate a situation with that many people dealing with two women, one of whom is the spouse of the woman who was presumably trying to get back in the car on the other side? Do you really think that she was going to try to run down the officer with no concern whatsoever for her spouse that was running alongside the car? Would that have happened? In other words, everything about this shows, if nothing else, very poor police work. But that the fact is that it aroused this panic situation in people that are supposedly trained to understand when they're dealing with a difficult human situation. You don't just pull guns, make threats, yell horrible epithets, and then after you've completed the assassination, if I've heard this correctly, referring to the person you've just shot as a bitch. Now, granted all those things, is there any evidence whatsoever that maybe there was anti-LGBT animus as a possible reason why this was happening? But what really bothers me is, as bad as it was to kill this woman, what is even worse is, prior to making any inquiry whatsoever, the Trump administration at every level, from the president to the vice president, even days later, still insists that this woman not only is dead, but that she has to be maligned by being called a domestic terrorist. Add all that together and the implications for American citizens, the message that is being put out, is we will kill you. We will kill you anytime we want. We will kill you no matter what you're doing, and we will not be held responsible for it. And even if it ever comes to trial, do not be surprised if it's a federal charge, if a pardon is issued. And that's maybe one of the reasons why they do not want the state to get involved, because a state crime cannot be pardoned by the president. They don't want anything about Minnesota. They don't want any of that in play. And that's, as a final thing, why is Minnesota, which is not the most violent place in America, why is it receiving all this attention and now another influx of ICE agents? Why is that happening? It's very simple. Because the vice presidential Democratic governor dared to run against Donald Trump and almost win. It was a very close election. Donald Trump does not have a mandate to rule like a king. And this is appalling, and it should be appalling for every American, no matter what, whether they're LGBT or not, but definitely for our community, because the message to us is we want to kill you.
Thanks, Sheila. So I have some things to say in reply, but first I want to see if Marcy has anything that she'd like to share.
No, that was a lot to unpack, and I agree with all of it.
Even though Renee Good was not transgender, the use of lethal force by federal agents is deeply relevant to transgender people who already experience disproportionate surveillance, criminalization, and violence by the state. LGBTQ people are often treated as suspicious by default. Queer and transgender people are more likely to be perceived as threatening or non-compliant or unpredictable by law enforcement. That perception increases the risk of escalation, especially for those of us who don't conform to gender norms. Militarized policing endangers marginalized communities first. ICE operates with military-style tactics, secrets, and impunity. Transgender people, particularly transgender women, trans immigrants, trans people of color, and poor trans people are often the first ones harmed when policing becomes more aggressive and less accountable. The narrative of self-defense is frequently used against marginalized victims. Claims of self-defense are routinely invoked when marginalized people are killed by police or federal agents. Transgender people know this pattern well, especially when victims are portrayed as responsible for our own deaths. And transgender people live constantly with risk calculations. Transgender people already navigate daily decisions about safety, about where to go, how visible to be, how to interact with authority. Incidents like this reinforce the fear that any encounter with law enforcement can turn deadly. Queer and trans families are especially harmed by state violence. Renee Good was a wife and a mother. Transgender people are disproportionately part of non-traditional and queer family structures that are often ignored or marginalized when violence occurs. And this compounds our harm and erasure. And transgender liberation is inseparable from opposition to state violence. Trans justice isn't just about using the bathroom or sports, or IDs. It's about whether the state treats our lives as disposable. The fight for trans liberation is inseparable from resisting unchecked state violence. As we all know, visibility does not equal protection. Even the LGBT community plus visibility, even as our visibility increases as a community, protection does not automatically follow. Renee Good's death shows that being seen, even as a citizen, even as a mother, doesn't guarantee safety. Trans people understand this contradiction intimately. Also, trans community have long histories of distrust with law enforcement. From Stonewall to today, trans people, especially trans women of color, have experienced police violence. Police are not protectors, but threats. And events like this reinforce that historical memory. But we must understand grieving for Renee Good must lead to structural change, not just mourning. Trans people are often asked to mourn quietly and to move on. But real honoring means demanding accountability, transparency, and changes to systems that repeatedly put marginalized people at risk. So those are my, that's mostly what I had to say. Sheila, if you'd like to close us out with some closing comments about Renee Good, that would be great.
Sure. Well, here's another very interesting thing that everyone that looks at the videos is going to notice, including a shot from the passenger side looking at the blood-smeared bag that deployed after the car crashed into a telephone pole because it was the person driving was now dead. Let's ask ourselves this question. No matter where or why or how she was out there that day, is it likely that someone smiling, talking to an officer and saying, I'm not even mad at you, is contemplating any of two things, that she's going to run that officer down or that she's going to be dead in the next few seconds? Is that likely in any way whatsoever? And the fact is, it wasn't. This was something that in her mind, she was going to go about the rest of her life, which then lay entirely before her, just as it does for all of us. And so where does the animus come from? What could possibly possess somebody to shoot three times to kill to an unarmed woman driving her car where her hands are involved in the steering wheel? And that was obviously not going to hit this man, except by his own being too close to the vehicle. Why didn't he step back? Why, rather than to step back, the more obvious thing, to save his own self, did he think it was imperative to kill her? This was not a life and death situation with her charging a barricade at 50 miles an hour and aiming at an officer the way it was portrayed. This was something in a snowdrift, presumably with icy wheels. You can't even build up any speed under those. She's starting from a dead stop. So what's going on here is a message to Americans: we will kill you when we can, we will kill you every time you can, and the message that they want us to get from the death of Renee is that we not only will do it, but we can do it, and we have a right to do it, and better beware if you exercise your First Amendment rights. So that's why my hope for not only our community, but for the all Americans, is to finally say, this is the tipping point. This is where we say enough is enough, and we say this regime is acting every single day, whether it's invading foreign countries or threatening to annex Canada and Greenland, is illegitimate and needs to be impeached.
Great. Well, thank you. That's a great ending. So you've been listening to Transpositive here on KBO Community Radio. We'd like to thank Marcy Grace Frederick for joining us tonight as our special guest, remembering Claire Hall. Marcy, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And Sheila, thanks again for being with us tonight, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Good night.
Hi, T, thank you for joining us on Trans Positive today. As we wrap up, we want to take a moment to celebrate and affirm the experiences of transgender, non-binary, and gender non-conforming people everywhere. Your identities, your voices, and your stories matter. You are valid, you are seen, and you are loved. Living authentically can sometimes be challenging, and the world doesn't always make it easy to claim the space you deserve. But every time you express your truth, every time you honor who you are making a powerful statement, not just to yourself, but to the people around you. You are contributing to a world that is more inclusive, more compassionate, and more aware of the beauty and diversity. Remember, there are spaces and communities, like this one, where you can be yourself without fear or judgment. Spaces where your creativity, your resilience, and your courage are recognized and celebrated. Your life, your voice, and your journey are significant. You have something important to offer, something unique that no one else can give. We encourage you to continue exploring, connecting, and supporting one another. Seek out friends, mentors, and local resources that affirm you, and know that it's okay to ask for help when you need it. Affirmation isn't just about external validation. It's about recognizing your own worth, honoring your experience, and allowing yourself to flourish.so, take pride in who you are. Stand in your truth. Celebrate your victories, your challenges, and your ongoing growth. Know that your presence in this world matters, that your story is powerful, and that you are never alone.
transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks, McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the U.S.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors.
Your co-workers.
Your students.
Your customers.
And even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
Transpositive is a bi-weekly program in Portland exploring themes important to those who identify as transgender, gender non-binary, and gender non-conforming. Transpositive tries to connect listeners with the ongoing activist, arts, culture, and dialogue happening in Portland and beyond. Make your voice heard. Transpositive PDX is open to new and experienced programmers, guests, and events you want our community to know about. We are an open collective. Anyone identify as trans, gender non-binary, gender fluid is welcome to be part of our collective after completing some basic free radio training. For more information, contact Emma at transpositiveapps@gmail.com.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Transpositive, and I'm also the current president of the board of directors here at KABU. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KBOO Community Radio.
Bedroom surprise. They call it climbing, and I call it.
This is Ray Lynn, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported us.